So it's like House of Gaga. House of
Chanel. Yeah.
It's like in Keith.
House of Old Navy.
House of Old Navy.
Welcome to One More Thing with Jay and Robert.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Robert. One More Thing is a podcast celebrating LGBTQ plus pop culture. Recorded live in Jay's living room. Happy Monday, everybody.
Happy Monday.
I hope everyone's doing well. I'm feeling kind of nervous. I'm excited.
Me too. Today we're interviewing someone we've never met.
Like, we've exchanged a couple of messages, and that's it. And I'm so happy and, like, surprised that he's so on board with coming in today. We saw this musical off-Broadway at the Lynn Redgrave Theater. Why can I never say that?
At the Lynn Redgrave Theater.
But the guy that we're having on the show today wrote it. He wrote the
whole book.
He wrote the music. He wrote the lyrics. He wrote
the stage directions.
So I'm so excited to, like, talk to him about all of that.
But it's very exciting because our previous interview episode, I had known Tom for a long time, so we had a sort of jumping off point. We had, like, a rapport ready to go. But for this, who knows what'll happen?
Really?
What if we left it on and, like, brought the computer downstairs?
That's what they do.
We were like, hey!
On RuPaul's podcast, they just sit down and they don't cut. It's just as long as it takes them to get through what they need to talk about. And in the Lady Gaga episode, Lady Gaga just shows up and, like, walks into the room and you hear, like, the door open and they're like, ah, she's here. And then you hear Lady Gaga, like, sit down and she's like, sorry, I'm late. And
is that your Lady Gaga impression?
That's my, like, Lady Gaga's late voice.
Sorry, I'm late. She sounds very sexy.
She sounds like Glenn Close in Sunset Boulevard. I'm coming out of makeup.
That's actually not bad.
Right?
It was also a little Albert Nobbs-y.
But you see what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Also, while I take my pills, let me just say, this episode is brought to you by PillPack, because...
Can't wait for PillPack to be the person.
I want them to sponsor us. PillPack, please sponsor us. We love you. I love you. Robert has no opinion.
Like,
PillPack has changed my life. I have to take 6 medications a day. And let me tell you, PillPack has revolutionized it. I don't ever have to, like, worry about pill reminders. I don't ever have to worry about, like, packaging up my pills for the day. I don't have to, like, set out my pills for the week. It just has them, like, ready to go, all set. The tiny little bags are recyclable and they're super easy to, like, fit in my backpack, so I don't have to carry around, like, a giant pill reminder. PillPack, please sponsor us. Get in touch.
I like
my email address is my full name at gmail.com.
So the View upstairs actually closed yesterday.
Yeah.
Which was bad scheduling.
It really was. We recorded this episode a long time ago.
Maybe we recorded this episode 3 months ago.
I thought we recorded it at the beginning of April.
We recorded this episode a month ago.
For those of you that didn't see it, basically it's about this guy, Wes, who lives in 2017 and is very active in social media and, like, society. And he decides that he wants to buy this kind of, like, run-down piece of property that just so happens to be the site of the upstairs lounge. And he's there with the realtor, and the realtor's like, so, like, do you want to buy it? And Wes is like, well, can I walk around for a little bit? And the realtor's like, sure, I'll leave you the keys and come back later. And he's like, okay. And he sings a song and, like, through the magic of theater, gets transported back to the night that the upstairs lounge burned down. And it's kind of a musical about Wes meeting all these characters that represent different parts of the LGBT community. And we saw it and you didn't.
We saw it twice. But if you didn't get to see it, there's a cast recording coming out in August that you can pre-order now on Broadway Records. We'll put the link in our newsletter, so subscribe to it.
Also, and I plan on bringing this up, looking, you know, because I stalked him to figure out things to talk about today. And
Robert wrote this episode. I usually write the episodes.
And
exciting.
His fashion sense is, I wish that I could pull the stuff that he wears off. It's so cool. And one of the things from the show that looks very him is the black leather jacket with, like, the spray-painted flower on it and the brooch.
Yeah.
And he has, like, a big thing for pins, apparently.
Can't wait to see if he's wearing a pin.
If he's not, I'm gonna call him out on it. Because I need
him
to be
wearing one. Don't worry, listeners. We will keep you updated.
Welcome to our podcast.
Hi.
We are gonna start off by, we've made a list. Okay, so first of all, I had to stalk you because I don't know you. This is my first time meeting you.
What? I'm like at least a Z-list gay celebrity at this
point. It was funny because at the end of the show, we were like, we have to have someone from the show
yeah.
on it.
Oh yeah, well, I'm so glad it happened that way. I mean, the reason I'm doing my stalking is because a lot of the people in our cast have the policy of they don't read any reviews, they don't wanna know what's out there in the world, which mm-hmm. I totally understand. So I kind of, after every performance, I just kind of go on like Instagram or Twitter or wherever, and I just kind of collect the responses. Like if people have really effusive responses to the show, and I just drop it in a folder, and I figure once our run is done, I'll send the people on our cast a folder with, you know, 1,500 of these different things to be like,
that's really sweet.
It was important that you did this, you know, thank you for being a part of the show. This is the impact you had on people. So, you know, it's weird because it's like my show is a critique of like, our dependence on social media and technology,
yeah.
and yet I'm embodying all of those things I hate right now because I can't fucking get off Facebook, Instagram, but I also feel like, you know, this is, I worked for 5 years to get to this point, so I feel like for me to not do that would be a missed opportunity, so.
So, okay, so in my stalking, I came across 5 facts that are going to be our fast 5 facts where I'm going to say the fact,
yeah.
and you're going to tell me if it's true or false.
Okay.
These are all facts about you, but I just
yeah.
want to know how true they are or how false they are. So the first fact is that you were the recipient of the Jonathan Larson Grant.
I was.
What did you receive it for?
Yeah, so that's it's a grant in musical theater that's administered by the Larson family through the American Theater Wing, and it's for your body of work. So I submitted songs and a libretto. I submitted the libretto for The View Upstairs and a few songs from that, but I also submitted some stuff from K-pop, which is my next musical that's happening at Ars Nova in the summer/fall, and then a few other different things. And it was super awesome that, you know, they gave me this grant, and it allowed me to quit my job and focus on writing for a year and developing this piece, which was really cool. And then weirdly, they like used a photo of me from the event at the Academy Awards and like a thing that was introduced by Sting. So that was really cool. So then like my family out on Long Island was like freaking out about that. So it was a nice moment. Yeah.
You were a gender and sexualities major at NYU.
I was, yeah.
When did you graduate?
Oh my God. I think 2010.
2010? Wow.
Yeah.
I also went to NYU.
Oh, you did? Were you?
I was
what
at Tisch.
School? Oh, nice. I did Tisch grad and Gallatin undergrad. And Gallatin is kind of like choose your own adventure school. So I did a lot of, like, half of me was split between, I showed up thinking I wanted to do music performance and music business stuff at Tisch. And then I ended up just getting really interested in, like, you know, Judith Butler, Foucault, all the cornerstones of a liberal arts education. And I got really interested in queer theory and stuff. Because when you tell people queer theory, they assume it's, like, specifically about gay history. But I think it's more about learning to see identity as something that's constructed and performed.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really fascinating. So, yes, gender and sexuality studies. A lot of, like, dissertations on, like queer nightlife in pre-AIDS communities in San Francisco and New York. The Anvil, the Mineshaft, all that. Watching clips of Bette Midler at the baths.
Okay, so our next one is that you're a visual artist who creates your own stage costumes.
Yeah, I used to. Not as much anymore. I mean, I would if I had a necessity, but I first started performing out in the city when I was 18, so going on 11 years ago, and I was totally broke, and I've always loved fashion and all that, but I had no money, so I would stay up every night, you know, till like 2 a.m. before a show when I had a concert, hot gluing my own outfits with, you know, googly eyes, sequins, kind of like very like DIY do-it-yourself. I would, you know, as an artist, I would draw my own poster images and stuff like that. And I've done side projects with art, like exhibited stuff at galleries, and I did the Halloween window display at Patricia Field 1 year in the Lower East Side.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I've lived a bunch of like weird different lives at this point.
Did you have any hand into the costumes in the show?
Anita Yavich, who did our costumes, is like a genius, so I would never, and she's like my favorite person of all time, so I would never pretend to like tell Anita Yavich what to do, but I will say that I had like, you know, some feedback every now and then where I would be like, hey, you know, like these pants you made look amazing, can we make them look even a little bit more couture by staining them a little bit darker and roughing them up a little bit, distressing
gotcha.
Them, hey, you know, this jacket is amazing, what if we put a pin on it, you know, like just little stuff like that.
Next one, you are the artist in residence at Rhinebeck Writers Retreat. And also the Johnny Mercer Writers Colony, or I guess a writer, an artist in residence?
True-ish. I was 2 years ago.
Oh.
Once upon a time, I did that, which was really fun.
At the same time?
I think they were kind of like back-to-back, yeah.
Wow.
Well, actually, no. One was in summer, one was in winter. I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know. Time feels very effusive. Like, ephemeral to me right now. Like, I don't know where I am.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've been in rehearsal for, like, the last, like, 2 months mounting the show, and the hours became very blurred together in the days. So I know that I did these things, but my perception of... I haven't had a moment to process the last year, so it's been very much a whirlwind, so...
Did you write any of the show with either of these places?
I did, yeah. I developed it a little bit at both. I wrote some songs at Goodspeed Opera House at the Johnny Mercer Colony, and I also, when I was at Rhinebeck Writers Retreat, I worked on churning out a new draft of it. Over the past 5 years, the contemporary element of the show, the 2017 part of it, has changed so radically because our world has changed. Right. You know, gay marriage became legal, Pulse happened, Trump got elected, and so over the past 5 years... I've had to rewrite and reimagine what the piece was so many times. So through lots of different fellowships and residencies, I've done that kind of work.
So when you started out, the show was just back in the day, and then you added the 2016?
No, there was always a contemporary element to it, but I would say the narrative of it back when I first started writing it in 2012 was different. It was more of someone who had only known things getting better, and so they needed to experience this kind of tragic event in the past to... Oh. kind of examine their own privilege, and now because our world became more complicated, that character became more complicated, and now I think it's more the story of someone who has experienced depression. He has grown up in a world in which Pulse happens and the pendulum is swinging back from progress, but he thinks his way of combating that is to become like a social media famous kind of presence, personality, and that it's kind of like his equivalent of Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind, of being like, oh, well, you know, I won't think about that today, I'll think about that tomorrow, you know.
Yeah.
His of like, it doesn't matter if the world is burning as long as I have like 1,000 likes on Instagram.
So you at some point were the co-writer and lead singer of a band called The Decades. Is that your band?
Decades, yeah. Oh my god, that was like 5 years ago at this point. But oh, yeah, cool. I was the lead singer of kind of this like dance punk LCD Sound System-esque disco rock band, and we played a bunch of really cool shows. We headlined like the electronic Williamsburg Electronic Music Fest or something like that with Diamond Rings and Fisher Spooner, and we got a lot of good press. And then kind of at like the height of when we were starting to get momentum, we like broke up.
So,
but it was a cute moment, and it informed a lot of the music actually that ended up being in the show. There's a lot of like kind of disco beats in the show, and coming from that world of living it with that kind of rock music, that informed the kind of music I knew I wanted to write for this, and what I wanted to, the kind of audiences I wanted to reach with musical theater.
So when did you go from performing in a band to like writing musicals?
Kind of around the same time. I wrote, my first love was musical theater. Like I grew up, you know, in the city before my parents got divorced, and I was always, you know, begging to go see musicals, to go to Broadway, to go to the TKTS booth and see what was there and try to see shows. And so I was like a little mini proto theater queen in the making. And then when I moved out to LA growing up in middle school, elementary school, I was very, very bullied, because I've always kind of been eccentric in my own way, and in a pre-Lady Gaga world where it was not acceptable to be wearing kimonos to school and 5-inch platform heels and eye makeup and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I became kind of embarrassed of my love of theater because I associated that with bullying, I think, and I kind of disappeared that identity from myself. And so I threw myself into like fashion and punk music and, you know, the whole drug, sex, and rock and roll thing. And then, so over the past... I was doing the singer-songwriter thing, but people would always tell me, you know, it sounds like you're exploring character. It feels like you need a bigger stage for your stuff. Have you ever thought about writing a musical? And I was always like, fuck musical theater, I don't want anything to do with that. Yeah, that's for losers. And then finally I was like, okay, maybe I'll try writing a musical. And then, like, the second I started, it was like, I caught the bug. It was like, I didn't leave my apartment for 3 weeks. I wrote 20 songs and, like, an 80-page script, and I just vomited out this musical that I think had been marinating in my subconscious for like 15 years. And then Ars Nova said that they wanted to workshop it, and so that was like 6 years ago. That was how I met Nathan Lee Graham. It was my first musical Wired, and I had such an incredible experience that I decided to go back to grad school to really learn the craft of what I was doing. So that kind of happened right around the same time that my band fell apart.
Got
so that. It was like, it was good timing. Yeah.
So you have a couple of musicals that you've written.
So I wrote Wired, I have The View Upstairs, I have K-pop, I have a song cycle about the apocalypse called Show and Tell. I have a show in development with this playwright, a named Jensa Warner called Nincest, which is about Anais Nin, the erotica writer.
And then you said K-pop was your next thing.
Yeah.
So what is that?
So K-pop is a musical about Korean pop music. I don't know if you know, like, Psy Gangnam Style. But we've created a fictional K-pop music label that's invading the United States. And we have all these fake artists we've created for the label. And they all have their own backstories and narratives. And there's a little bit of a Sleep No More element of the show where it takes place in two different theaters on different floors of the theater. And you walk around and explore these spaces, and all the songs feel like all of a sudden you're thrown into a K-pop music video, and it's so on the surface it's about like celebrity and pop culture, and it's very high fashion and neon in 2017 Korea, but it's also about what it means to be a model minority, about nationalism and authoritarianism in North Korea, and white supremacy in Asian culture of plastic surgery, and how Korea relates to China and Japan, and all these different things that are kind of underneath the surface that are deeper than just the celebrity pop surface.
So we have to go see that because that sounds right up our alley.
It's gonna be, that show's going to be wild. It's going to be being thrown into the Willy Wonka factory. Only it's Korean pop stars.
It seems like you have like a relationship with Ars Nova because you've got a bunch of stuff that's been workshopped there or done there.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, they hosted me for a concert 9 years ago.
Wow.
So I've got a really... they're kind of the closest thing I have to a theatrical home. And it was Jason Egan, the artistic director, who kind of encouraged me to do this reading of this musical that I had in development back when no one would take a chance on me. It's still hard to get people to take a chance on me. I mean, I think, unfortunately, because theater is so expensive, you have so many theaters that their mission statement is emerging writers, but their idea of what an emerging writer is Pulitzer Prize finalist, two-time Obie Award winning, you know, and like a non-emerging writer is like Edward Albee.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, Ars Nova is one of the few institutions where you actually can get in the doors if you are a new up-and-coming writer, and they totally changed my life because they workshopped my musical Wired, and I've been developing K-pop with them for the past 3.5 years, so it's really exciting. I've done residencies and different things, and so it's really cool to be a part of their family in that way.
Did they like see a workshop of Wired and bring it to them, or did they just commission you blind, or did you apply?
So the way they found me was it was still in the days of MySpace.
I did
a cover of a Katy Perry song.
Which Katy Perry?
I Fist a Girl, which randomly, I don't know how, but it was one of those like weird internet moments where
It went crazy viral
for a second. Now I've tried to scrub it from the internet. For like 2 years I was known as that like weird Katy Perry cover dude, and I like hated that because I was like, that's not me, that's not like, this was a joke. Like I did it as like in 15 minutes in the studio as a joke, and then like it got picked up by New York Magazine, and all of a sudden overnight it had like 250,000 hits online. So that was really unexpected, but someone from Ars Nova saw it on MySpace, and they brought me in for concert, and then we just kind of stayed in touch over the years, and they were just like, hey, have you ever thought of doing theater? And it was like, funny you asked. I just started writing this thing. And they were like, oh, well, can you send us a script? And I did. And they were just like, hey, we want to workshop this.
So
and that was kind of back in the Wild West days of Ars Nova. Like, now I don't know if you could totally do that. Because, like, now post, you know, Lin-Manuel getting discovered there, and Bridget Everett and Billy Eichner and Natasha Peer and all this stuff, they're kind of known now as, like, a real hub. So now I think you need to probably go through AntFest and kind of come up over a longer period of time. But yeah, back then Jason Egan, the artistic director, was just like, hey, do you want to do this? And I just kind of did it. So that it was good, like good confluence of being at the right time in the right place.
So you've talked about Wired a couple times. What is Wired?
Wired was a musical I wrote about the singularity. So the singularity is this like hypothetical thing that they think is going to happen in 2040 where robots no longer need us to replicate themselves and create new forms of technology. And so like basically it's like the world will radically transform at that point, and robots will become cognizant. And so it was an origin story of that, and the whole score was electronic, and that was also kind of a little bit about celebrity and stuff like that. So that, weirdly enough, that led to my involvement on K-pop, because Woodshed Collective approached Ars Nova and said that we've got this idea for a show about Korean pop stars, but we don't know anyone in musical theater who writes electronic music. Do you know? Yeah, and I was like, hey, it's kind of like my creative wheelhouse. So the Ars Nova made the love connection there.
Your musical, The View Upstairs. I didn't know what it was in the weeks leading up to seeing it, and then through a process of events, found out what it was.
You didn't know what the upstairs lounge was.
Yeah. I had no idea. And then I found out, for the people that are listening to this that do not know what it is, because I feel like there's a large amount of the gay community that don't know what it is. What is the story with the upstairs lounge?
So the story of the upstairs lounge is the upstairs lounge was a gay bar in 1973 in New Orleans at a time in which it was straight up illegal to be gay. You know, you'd be arrested if you were found wearing more than two pieces of clothing of the opposite gender. So these people were kind of brave outlaws who went to this place. But at the same time, it was thought to be a community where you could feel safe, if not outside, inside. It was like a haven, and there was cruising, there was drag shows, there were weirdly church services from the MCC Church, which was the first church to allow openly gay clergy, and also it was a piano bar. So I kind of feel like even if it hadn't burned down, it would be one of the kind of legendary gay bars in our history, and so it's really sad to me that people don't know it. There's a multiplicity of reasons why people don't know the history. Part of it is because no one even wanted to admit that they were there that night. You know, the media came and they wanted to interview some people, and people wouldn't put their faces on camera because they could lose their jobs, they could lose their housing. Also, because there was such homophobia in the South at the time, the police never investigated the crime or convicted anybody. I mean, they did like a very perfunctory investigation, but it was kind of like open and close the books. And it was in and out of the papers within 2 days. And what's so crazy is that like the week before, there was a fire in New Orleans that 3 people died in, and the mayor, the governor, all the local clergymen came out and made statements on it. And then there was radio silence when the upstairs lounge fire happened and 32 people died, and they left some of the bodies even in the window for a couple days. The nearby churches would not hold services to bury the people who died there. Families didn't come forward. Most likely, the person who committed the arson attack was someone from the community who was a gay hustler. So it's not as easy to reclaim this in art. It's more complicated than just saying this is a cut and dry hate crime. Mm-hmm. I think that's also part of why we don't talk about it. It's painful to us. But it's like, if we don't talk about it, the shit happens again.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people say Omar Mateen at Pulse was gay and that he had been there and that they had seen him on the different apps as well. So I think homophobia is a danger, but I think internalized self-loathing is also as much of a threat to our community.
When did you get the idea to turn it into a musical? Because when I realized that it was about the upstairs lounge and what that all was, I was like, but it's a musical.
Sounds like a horrible
yeah.
idea.
Yeah.
For a musical.
Yeah. Wait.
Right? You're like, oh my God, is it going to be like, oh my God, there's a fire in the corner over there. Yeah. Nah, nah. Exactly. That is the version of the musical I 100% did not want to write. My whole thing is that if you're going to have a show in which 32 people die and you're going to talk about tragedy, then like you need to show them living their lives before they die. And that to me is like, even though it is about the fire, it to me, it's more about the conversation that stems out of that, of using the fire to ask, are we better, are we worse, how much have we really changed? And I think the show is kind of a celebration of the past in a way. So I don't, even though it's sad at the end, I feel like it's hopeful too. And I didn't want it to just live only in melodrama the mm-hmm. entire time.
From all of the photos that had been released, I was like, are they going to do the fire? Or
yeah.
is this just going to be about the upstairs lounge and like talk about that stuff,
we
but it's going to end before the
talking.
Fire? And when we saw it, we were at the most center table.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We got
you guys get upgraded?
Down.
Yeah.
That's fun. Yeah.
We were in
happen.
The last row. And then
they took us down.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Actually, it was my professor's fault that I wrote this, because it originally started out as my thesis project at, you know, the graduate musical theater writing program at Tisch. And, you know, they asked me to come up with a bunch of ideas, and then they were going to advise me on which one I should do for my thesis. And I kind of had a bunch of kooky, zany, Rocky Horror-esque ideas. And then this was my last one that kind of like slipped in there, like the liver in the casserole that you're trying to hide in there. That you're like, please don't make me do this one. And of course they made me do this one because I was the most afraid of it. Because I was like, how can I write this? Like there's some, I as an activist, I was interested in telling the story, but I didn't want to fuck it up and have like, you know, the ghosts of faggotry past covered in chains, like hovering above me in my sleep at night being like, you fucked up our story.
Yeah.
So I decided, I was like, there's something to this because one, I love the music from that time period. So I knew that I could write a sexy, badass rock score with lots of clav and rock
yeah.
organ and stuff like that. And I knew that also, because the people that would go to this bar had to be extremely courageous, that they would be larger-than-life characters that would be very theatrical in a way. There was something about the theme of community that resonated with me. I knew that because there was a piano player there that could write lots of cabaret-esque, diegetic music for the show that would be exciting. But ultimately, because I was a queer studies major, I had so many complicated thoughts about my relationship to my past. I was someone who, as a queer person, grew up without any mentors, and maybe that's because of AIDS. There's a link lost in the chain, but I never had that experience of going out to a bar and some older queen taking me under their wing and being like, child, this is how you exist in this world, and I had to just kind of figure that all out myself. I wanted to do the show to examine my own history through a story of forgotten history with our community, and to figure out what I can learn from the past and how is that useful for me to figure out how I exist in this world in 2017 where all this crazy shit is going on.
And you talked earlier about how, as you've written multiple drafts, sort of like as the time changes, the show changes.
Yeah.
And so did you kind of, last year was kind of like a banner year for Horrible Things. Was there sort of like a, you know, between the last draft of it and the draft that is currently at the Lynn Redgrave Theater, did you have sort of like a crisis about like, oh God, now I have to put Trump in?
Well, wait. So what is your show about?
Oh.
Because we talked about the Upstairs Lounge, but I want to quickly mention that there is a time warp.
Yeah, to me the show is about
because
using...
Because I lost my shit.
It's about using a forgotten tragedy in our history to have a conversation and intergenerational love affair between 1973 and 2017, and to examine what we've gained and lost in our march towards equality, and to learn some lessons from the past that empower us to continue the fight going forward.
I didn't really realize that there was going to be, like, a...
modern day part?
Yeah, and one of my... this is embarrassing, but one of my favorite movies growing up was this movie called My Friend Martin, which was about these, like, two white kids. It was a cartoon, and these two white kids that get, like, transported back on Martin Luther King Day to the era of the civil rights movements and stuff like that. No, it was just a, like, straight to VHS thing, and they, like, learn about Martin Luther King Jr. and, like, all of the things, and at the end of the movie, he makes the speech, and then they go back to the 90s, and they're like, wow, we've learned so much. When we were sitting there and the lights went out and
Jeremy Pope
walks in with the reeler.
Oh my god, were you gagging?
I grabbed her leg and fully gasped.
Yeah.
And was like, I cannot believe this right now.
That's my favorite part of the show. I love the way that first song he sings, hashtag household name, is staged, where all of a sudden 2017 and 1973 are existing at the same time, but they're like barely missing each other.
Yeah.
It feels very Follies to me.
As soon as the lights went down and they came in, I was like, is this Follies? What's happening? Like, literally, because I thought that it was right after the fire and people were coming in, and I was like, oh my god. And then I realized it was 2017, and I grabbed Robert back and was like, something's happening
here. I know, I reacted, and then I felt you react, and I was like, oh no, we didn't want to, like, freak out too much because
we were on stage.
I mean, if you really want to be super, super, super reductive about what the show is, you could say it's like Christmas Carol, but Ebenezer Scrooge is like a fashionista from Bushwick in 2017.
Yep. Yep, that's it. How many of the characters are based on real people?
Basically all of them. I mean, I made a creative decision early on that I was not going to use the real names of people because look, if you had a relative that died in a catastrophic event that was not like Cher or a public figure, and then 40 years from now, some person who didn't know them wrote them into a play and was putting words in their mouth and thoughts in their head, like, I would be deeply offended.
Yeah.
And so I was like, it's not my place to do that. And in fact, so many of the people have never even commented on it. Like the bartender, Buddy Rasmussen, who actually led a group of like 60 people to safety through an exit in the back, but his partner died in the fire. He's never commented on it and won't give interviews. So I was like, well, I can't make him the bartender and make him a character. So I would say the characters are composites of the research I did of the real people that were there. There was a real priest there who was giving a service for the MCC church. There was a mother actually with her two sons there. There was a piano player. And then there were three men who were unknown, who died in the fire. And so, spoiler, one of the main love interests is one of those characters. So I invented a story for him. But the arsonist was this hustler, Dale Nunez, that had been thrown out.
For people who haven't seen it, the bartender is a lesbian, a butch lesbian.
That I did invent. I mean, there were lesbians who went to the bar occasionally. But to me, the reason why I put her into the narrative is because one of the most moving stories I read when I was doing my research was that after the fire happened, they had such a hard time finding a place that would do a memorial service because all the churches, Lutheran, Baptist, etc., you know, turned them down. And finally, they found a place that, like an Episcopal church, that would do a service. But then all the media gathered in the front after they walked in. And so there was a back exit. And they, after the service, they said, you know, if you guys want to go out the back exit, we should probably do this now because otherwise our faces are going to be on camera. And of course, it was a brave lesbian who stood up and was like, fuck that. I walked in the front door and I'm going out the goddamn front door. And so then they had this beautiful civil rights movement where, like, because of the courage of this lesbian woman, they all all walked out the front and they were like, screw you, media, we're here. And like that, I thought was like so beautiful. Actually, shortly before the Upstairs Lounge was burned down, a few months before the MCC Church in Los Angeles was also firebombed. And the head of the MCC Church, Troy Perry, said this beautiful thing, which was, when our church burned down, the closet burned down with it. And I love that. So that's why I wanted to reclaim lesbians in the narrative too, because I feel often in queer history, they are erased from our history.
I just have to tell this story. So the show kind of starts and you're just kind of like in the audience and then the characters kind of come in and it becomes this bar atmosphere before the song, or before the opening number starts. So Jay is in love with Miriam Shore, like, to the T. And we had two swings and an understudy on, and the swing for...
You thought she was Miriam Shore?
She, like, popped up from the bar, and I was like, Jay. And she looked, and we both had a panic attack because we thought that just both of us didn't know that Miriam Shore was going to be in
the
show.
Somehow, despite the fact that, like, we know everything about Miriam Shore, we thought somehow we had missed it, and Miriam Shore was going to be in this, and legitimately we were both like, we have to leave, and it was not her.
That's hilarious.
But then through the whole show, like during the drag number, when he's like up on the piano and everyone's kind of around him and they're like throwing the confetti and stuff, I'm like, oh wow, I'm having such a great time, and I look over at Jay and she's watching the bartender like on the other side with the
is
mop. I'm pretty sure it just was Miriam Shore.
I like to imagine.
I think for that one performance, April Ortiz was not in the show. It was Miriam Shore.
Was it always meant to be immersive?
I was open to either interpretation, but our director, Scott Ebersole, was very passionate about it being an immersive show because he felt like the audience had to go on the same journey that Wes went on in terms of encountering these patrons, becoming essentially, because it is immersive, the audience is essentially cast as patrons in the Upstairs Lounge. So it feels that much more immediate to you, and I think the loss feels more powerful because of that. So that immersive staging and idea of that was very much Scott's.
I don't know if it was just because of how center we were sitting, but through the entire show, I couldn't see the audience. I could see the other people sitting at the tables, but because the majority of the audience was behind me, I was like, oh wow, I can't believe we're at a show where there are four people in the audience,
and we're all sitting in this bar.
And they were probably looking at you.
Oh yeah, it was great. I had a blast.
He's on a lot of action.
The cabaret tables are a fun way to do that show.
Robert got a lot of like cast members hitting on him.
I was felt up by like, I mean, felt up, like my shoulder was felt up by like everyone. Great. And the first time it happened, I was like, okay.
I love that.
And then there was one point where the Willie character said something up to me about me like hooking with people in bathrooms and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
And
nowadays, you can't walk into a bathroom without 10 guys following you into your stall.
Yeah, and I was like, well, that has never happened to me. okay, and I was like, am I supposed to, like, around my name right now? I don't know. But it was because I was so, like, lost in the fact that no one else was there with me besides the people just sitting at the tables, who was great, by the way. The swing that went on, or the understudy that went on
for Willie,
because he was usually the cop.
The cop,
right?
I'm so bummed. So I was gone for the last 2 weeks. I was in Lisbon and Morocco, so I missed, and I had a kidney stone. It's been a wild couple months. But while I was gone, all of the swings did like all of the roles in the show. So, and I missed it. So I am such a theater fan, so like I geek out on that. What's amazing is that there's a, like, April Ortiz, there's a version of it where she plays the priest. You know, the actor who plays Charlie is also a swing for Buddy. Michael Longoria, who plays Freddy, is also a swing for Wes. The actor who plays Dale is also a swing for Wes and Patrick.
I love that kind of stuff. Like, I want to see, like, every...
We have to go every time.
Oh, yeah. So it's like, when one person's out, it's, like, fine. But, like, when two or three people are out, the show starts to get busted and weird in a way that is... Not busted, because, like, they're talented, but, like, just really, like, kind of miscast in a way that is exciting. But they're all such believable, like, talented actors that I think it doesn't... You just kind of go with the experience.
Oh, and, yeah, when April walked out, and I... After we realized that it wasn't Miriam Shore, and I realized that she was the Frenchie Davis character, I was like, oh, she's the Frenchie Davis character.
Well, our understudy tracks are really difficult for the show because we had fun actors that could play a homophobic cop and a flamboyant queen, play a butch lesbian and a 6-year-old Latina mother. Do you know what I mean? Those are like broad ranges, but they do it.
Hi, it's us in the future. Really quickly, we saw the view upstairs a second time, and this time the Miriam Shore lookalike was playing the preacher. Like, I don't even have anything to say about it.
First of all, we walked into the theater and we were like, the idea this time of seeing the show would be that there would be no understudies. Not that we're against it, but we wanted to see the show with its full cast. We walk in and immediately there are understudies. And we were like, oh my gosh. And we were freaking out that they were going to be the same ones. And then we were like, oh, no, no, no. Okay, so this is how it's going to be. And then we were like, April Ortiz is playing the preacher. And Jay was like, do you think she'll be playing it as a man or as a woman? And we walk in and she comes out for the, like, pre-show. And she is in a deep purple button-up with the little, like, preacher collar. And a, like, black blazer with these, like, 70s pattern, almost bell bottoms, but like tight pants, and these, like, they look like Doc Martens.
Yep.
And I was like, oh my god.
And she played the preacher as a lesbian.
Yep.
So
with a nice little southern dialect.
Yeah. So that was fine.
In writing the show, was there anything that you, through the rehearsal process, had to cut and, like, get rid of that you loved? Like, did you have to kill any of your darlings?
I'm very not precious about my writing. Like, if something's not working, like, I'll cut stuff. So I think at the beginning of the rehearsal process, the show was 89 pages, and then by the time we got to opening night, it was 81.
Oh, wow.
So I was, like, hacking and slashing at dialogue, because also it's like, I'd never seen lighting and sets and costumes and all that, and all that does so much storytelling for you where you don't need as much expositional writing to be like, here's what's going on, because you can see it. So I cut a ton of dialogue, and I had two songs originally in the show. One was called Impossible Mess and one was Crazy Notion, and I was always like, I love both these songs, but they're like, they both kind of feel like they're doing the same thing. And so a week before opening night, I turned them into one song.
Oh.
And so now that song he sings on the piano, that kind of like slow jazzy song, was one of those songs, and it became the lead-in into the other song.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it became like a mashup, but it did lots of stuff like that throughout the process.
One of my favorite parts of the show, and I told Jay this as soon as we left, is the leather jacket that Wes wears the entire show with the yellow rose spray painted on the back of it. I walked out and was like, I wish that I could pull that off, because I would have stolen it off my shoulders.
Yeah.
That's why I felt about all the like gold and silver at the end. Mm. Like, they all came out one by one, and I was like, oh, I need that. Oh, I need that.
She did.
Oh, I need that.
During the bow, she was like, we need every single piece.
Yeah, because the show wasn't gay enough, we also had to add a fashion show.
Yeah.
Just, like, up it, like, another, like, 10%.
Yeah. Honestly, I was like, I need those shoes, and I need that jacket.
We love the red Solo Cup dress. That was, honestly,
so
I
good.
Cried.
And then when, like, the clowns shoot out of the tits with the confetti, it's so fun.
That was a really great reveal, too.
Yeah.
When you saw it, was Anthony, our Swing, was playing Freddy, right?
No, it was Michael.
Or was he the cops? It was Michael.
Yeah, okay. It was the Swing was the cop, and then the cop was Willie. And then April was the bartender.
Yeah. And Michael was Michael.
Okay, yeah.
Cool. Yes.
I mean, the thing that we really can't ignore is how upfront putting the 70s against today is, and you talk about, like, not to name names, but, like, Grindr and, like, all of the all of the movements that, like, have happened since.
Yeah,
and all
that must not be named.
Yeah. But my favorite thing that you talked about, but, like, was never in the foreground, really, was the treatment of the cops when the cop comes in the 70s and how that's treated, and then how Wes reacts to it versus when the cop comes in 2017 and how that goes.
Yeah, it's a little bit different where, like, he always immediately puts his hand up because it's, like, in 2017 he knows that, like, there's police brutality and he's a black kid in a building and he could get shot.
So one of my favorite parts about the show, undeniably, is the set by Jason Sherwood.
Sure, yeah.
What is your favorite part of the set? Because I have mine and it's really weird.
I mean, I do think when the show is over, there's going to be, like, a Hunger Games for that dildo chandelier. Of, like, who gets that? But,
that was both of our favorite part.
I think that's really fun. I love it. It's like Natasha Pierre and the Great Butt Plug of 1973. But actually, to me, weirdly, like, my favorite things are, like, the hidden photo collages. Like, I love that, like, hidden behind a curtain, we have, like, a black power wall with, like, photos of Diana Ross and Audre Lorde and Malcolm X and all this stuff.
Oh,
like, there's so many things hidden and tucked away throughout the sets. Like, there's even actor dick pics hidden. I won't say where, but they're there. Yeah, you gotta go back and you gotta do, like,
we're just gonna be like looking around there, be like, you need to sit down. We're like, we need time.
Yeah, but there's so many treasures, and over the course of the show, the set changes a little bit because actors keep bringing things from their apartments, and I bring in things, and it just gets more and more cluttered and more lived in and destroyed and damaged in a way that I think is cool.
My favorite part of the set was when you walk in from being in the lobby. There's
that little chair and table.
Yeah, where you're not quite.
Yeah, I even that to me is honestly honestly one of my favorite parts, too.
I loved it.
Because I love the way the newspaper has papered over the glass, so it immediately tells you, I'm going into a place where I'm, like, an outlaw.
And I know your favorite thing on the set was at the end, we almost waited until everyone had left, and the crew started coming in and kind of, like, resetting and grabbing everything. And she walked up to the bar and was like, I just need to know what book the bartender was reading.
She was reading a book the whole time.
Oh, yeah, it's called, like, Les Be Good to Me.
Yeah. And I went up and, like, looked at it, and I was like, great, I'll gotta go on Amazon.
Another thing that's really cool is that on the bar, Mod Podge onto the bar, are photos of the actual patrons who were at the upstairs lounge, so that's, like, a little Easter egg too, so they're there with us every night, like spiritually.
That's really exciting.
And I also love that what's so cool about what I and Scott told Jason was, like, we want you to feel free to create the gay bar of your fantasy and your dreams, mm-hmm. but we do want to also pay homage to the real elements that were at the upstairs lounge. There was a nude Burt Reynolds cardboard cutout hanging from the ceiling. There was that red flocked wallpaper. There were those red velvet curtains. There were those three, like, large New Orleans style windows with the bars on them. So what is amazing to me is that, like, you walk in and it's like we actually have recreated the upstairs lounge for you in a way that approximates what it might have been like to be there.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
The character of Dale versus the stigma with the community.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one character that I was really interested the whole time because I didn't know what was happening with him. And then at the end when he's like, why are you totally okay with helping
Patrick.
Yes. But you're not gonna help me. And then he sings a song. And at the end of it, I was like, I, like, needed to know so much more about him, and I wish that the show could have been another hour longer to, like, really go into it.
Yeah. I feel the same way. I mean, that character is a little bit of an enigma. He was, like, an outcast in Dale Nunez and his community, and he didn't have too many friends, and, like, a year after the Upstairs Lounge fire, he killed himself. And he was someone who, when he would get really drunk afterwards, he would sometimes confess to people that he had committed this arson attack, and he said that he just wanted to get people's attention. Because he felt ignored in the community, and he probably had some psychological problems. And, like, weirdly, apparently, there's a lot of people that connect the Upstairs Lounge fire, like, through conspiracy theories to the assassination of JFK, believe it or not, because they say that
she loves
Roger Dale Nunez lived in, like, a shanty house with Lee Harvey Oswald. And that they were both gay and may have hooked up.
Oh.
At one point. So wrap your head around that.
Can't wait to watch
it. He's a fascinating character, and I think what he represents is that our community will always throw people under the bus.
Yeah.
And that can be the product of it. Like, I've been to gay pride parades where I've seen, like, Muscle Chelsea, you know, Jim Queen standing around saying, you know, why do these people need to wear these, you know, feathers and their rainbows, and, you know, they're holding back equality, and if we could just be like everybody else, then we would be accepted, you know? And I think what the show is trying to say is that there's not one correct way to be queer. We need to make space for everybody in our community, even people who are not as attractive, and I don't mean that physically, but I mean financially, emotionally, mentally. We need to make space for those people.
That being said, the last question that I had was, the upstairs lounge, and especially the space that you make, is very homey, isn't the right word, but it gives across a sense of community, and so does the show. So what is your favorite gay bar?
Maybe Eastern Bloc. Well, I mean, look, I go to different bars for different things. Like, I go to Eastern Bloc when I want some, like, vintage pornography on screens and, like, a little tiny, you know, shithole that I can dance in. I'll go to, you know, the Duplex and the Monster if I want a piano bar. But I tend to like busted bars. I even like Pieces. Pieces is, like, this horrible bar that I love that just feels very, like, lived in and loved by the people who go there, who probably are going there only because it's the first gay bar they ever went to when they were 17, and it still has nostalgia for them.
It was the first one that I went to when I moved here.
So this is Sex on Legs from The View Upstairs, which is the song that we talked about a little bit where the drag queen performs in a dress made of red Solo cups.
Yeah.
And it also happens to be the number that I did not watch because I was watching the hot bartender mop.
This is also the number that I got covered in confetti. But this is Max Vernon singing.
Enjoy.
I was hooked from the start, you're like a work of art. I'm a box without a prize, but one of these days I'm gonna steal you away and all that implies. Cause you're sex on legs, I'm oh so shy. One look and I turn into a 50s housewife. In my mind I'm screaming out your name. But in life I got no pain. they hide and slowly die inside. The effect is rather strange. Like a sense-deprived fly, I've been buzzing around blind. Won't you drop me a crumb for a change? 'Cause your sex on legs, I'm oh so shy. Well, look in my time into a 50s housewife in my mind. I'm screaming out your name. How to fall so hard, I can't even recall. Other than your body, don't impress me at all. Won't look you in the eyes, I'll check my phone 10 times. I'll never gawk again. Suck. In my personal hell, if I had a soul to sell, I'd trade it in for just one. Oh, 'cause your sex on the legs, I'm oh so shy. One look and I turn into a 50s housewife in my mind. I'm screaming out your name.
At the end of every episode, we play a game. It's called One More Thing, and it's the last thing that we do before we send off the end of the episode. So today we've come up with 10 questions.
Rapid fire.
Yeah, and it's one thing or another, and you have to choose one first thing that comes to your head.
Okay.
Will and Grace are friends.
Will and Grace.
Lady Gaga or Madonna?
Madonna.
Angela Weber or Stephen Sondheim?
Sondheim.
Good. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert or Tu Wong Fu?
Tu Wong Fu! Sorry, that's so scandalous. But...
Wow. Jane Fonda or Lily Tomlin?
Lily Tomlin.
Oh, good. Map Omar or Anderson Cooper?
Anderson Cooper.
Bianca Del Rio or Bob the Drag Queen?
Bianca Del Rio.
New York or Chicago?
New York.
Ryan Murphy or Shonda Rhimes?
Shonda Rhimes.
Good. Betty Davis or Joan Crawford?
Betty Davis.
Wow.
Oh.
Controversial in this house.
I'm not watching Feud, though, so I don't know where my sympathy should lie, but just as, like, a person in
okay, in okay, that's, I can take
that's
that.
That's very fair. Very fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. I loved it, though. He's so cool.
He's so cool. That was so fun.
Also, for everyone that was not here with us, which is everyone, I was obsessed with what he was wearing.
Yeah, he was not wearing a pin.
No, but I made it. He made it up. He was wearing like
a giant statement necklace, giant, like Miriam Shaw.
Yeah, and the I don't know what to call it. The bottom part of it, like
the thing on it.
Yeah, like the charm. Maybe was just like a giant, like almost as big as his head.
Yeah,
like I'm assuming fake. What's it called? The like green
emerald.
No, it's like almost granite. Like you see it a lot in like Asian art. I can't remember. I don't know. It was a big stone.
It was cool.
It was beautiful. And then he was wearing these like patchwork cotton sewn together pants.
He was
like,
all black and white. He matched the cat.
He did. It looked like if you were doing a version of The Wizard of Oz and the Scarecrow came out and was in like a couture costume that was all black and white, and it looked so good. He looked so good. I want his fashion sense secretly, but I could never pull it off. Also, as a last tidbit, I just want everyone to know that he actively did not comment on the fact that there is a life-size cardboard cutout of Santana Lopez at his feet.
Go see The View upstairs, playing the Lynn Redgrave Theater.
Really, and there's a lot of stuff that we talked about off air because I didn't want to spoil like a lot of the show.
But it's really great. It's really fun. You'll have a nice time. You already know how it ends. They all die.
Spoiler alert. It's based off a fire where everyone died.
If you go on the right night, you'll get to see all kinds of understudies and swings like we did. You might get to see Miriam Shore have a cameo.
You can go follow Max Vernon at Max Vernon, or go to his website, which is maxvernon.com.
Very simple. Just type his name in and you will find him.
Wow, look at this jacket he's wearing in his Twitter picture.
That's a good jacket and a good shirt. Thank you so much to Max Vernon for coming on, talking to us, and having a great time and not getting annoyed by the cat.
Yeah, Sia was going crazy through that
whole
episode.
She was really going crazy.
And I'm pretty sure we're not going to be able to cut it out.
Yeah, you're just going to hear like, in the background.
Yeah, so thanks to Sia.
Thanks to my cat for being consistent.
Thanks to Instagram for hooking us up with Max.
Thanks to Lynn Redgrave for having the theater.
Yeah, thanks to Jason Sherwood for having a great set.
Thanks to everyone who died at the Upstairs Lounge for being our forefathers and mothers in the movement for equality. Thanks to my roommate, Rachel. Thanks to Miriam Shore, as always.
And also, I mean, thanks to the cast and just everyone involved with The View Upstairs.
Yeah, thanks to the house manager who moved us down to the stage.
That was great. As always, thanks to Sarah Kleiss and Stephanie Hawkins
right.
for basically letting this whole podcast happen.
Yeah. Yikes.
As always, if you're not already, go follow us on Instagram and Twitter at One More Thang, because Thang was taken.
One More Thang.
I don't like this. You can also hit that subscribe button and keep getting our episodes every week.
Smash that motherfucking subscribe button.
I do not like that. Go wash your mouth out.
Have a nice life. Goodbye. That was beautiful. You did such a good job expressing yourself.
Not life size, she's larger than life.
I'm pretty sure that's life size.
No, Naya Rivera is shorter than me, and that cutout is taller than me.
Do her feet start at the floor?
No. Yeah, her feet do
no,
start at the
heels
floor.
Are.
Yes, look, her feet
heels,
start at the floor.
Yeah, the toes are, but the heels are up off the ground.
She's short. She's like my height.
And
I've really?
Met Naya
You're
Rivera.
Next to her.
Except she was sitting.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. She's short. Maybe she just looks big because I'm always looking up at her from below. Rachel, stay here with me.